This is the fourth in my series of autobiographical monologues, and in this episode I'm talking about how I got involved with text composition and typesetting in the decade before desktop publishing arrived. That is, from 1975 to 1985. I've been interested in letter forms for a long, long time. An interest sparked in me in my last year of primary school, when Mr. Duffy taught our class how to do italic handwriting. That got me interested in calligraphy generally. Now, in my second recorded episode, I talked about using spirit and stencil duplicators. The text for these was either handwritten or produced on a manual typewriter. When I went to Glasgow University, I rapidly equipped myself with an Adler Gabriel semi-portable typewriter. The design of its typeface, as well as an ability to cut a duplicator stencil, were my two main purchasing criteria. In my third recorded episode, that took me into the mid to late 70s when I learned how to produce camera-ready artwork for printing on an offset lithographic press. This printing technology, with its photographic means of making a printing plate, was highly liberating. Any technology that could produce sharp-edged, high-contrast lettering was now eligible as a means of typesetting, and you could mix methods too, just by pasting the different outputs onto your artwork. So, for example, for Movement, the Student Christian Movement magazine, we commissioned typesetting for the body copy, and we made headlines with letter-set rub-down type. Now, in this episode, as I said, my focus is on my experience of typesetting before 1985. But if these recordings are going to be about my life and my times, I should rewind and give you some historical background about how getting type ready for printing had been evolving in the second half of the 20th century. Now, I guess a lot of people already know that in the 15th century, Johannes Gutenberg and sundry other experimenters devised a way of printing pages from an assembled collection of individual metal types, each type character being a kind of small stamp at the upper end of a pillar of rectangular section. In the print shop, compositors would laboriously pick these individual types from the storage case, assemble them into filled-out lines of text, and stack the lines next to each other to make up a column of type. These serried ranks of little lead soldiers would then get boxed in with spacing material and locked into an iron frame called a chase. The chase got transferred to the bed of a press. Then the raised faces of the type matter were coated with ink, and paper was pressed hard onto the type matter to transfer the inked impression onto the page. And this was letterpress printing, and for four centuries it hardly changed at all. Now, I do have some experience of letterpress type composition and printing, but only in a dabbling, hobbyist kind of way. Around 1981, someone gave me a small hobbyist's letterpress printing machine of the Adana brand, and with it a collection of metal types, spacing material, a composing stick, and other supplies. I used this press to print business cards and other small items, not only from the metal type I acquired with the press, but also from wooden blocks that I engraved myself, zinc-lined blocks that I had made up from artwork, and lino cuts. Shortly afterwards, 1981 I think it was, I enrolled for a year at Goldsmiths College in South London in their Department of Graphic Communication as what they called an ad hoc student. Basically, this meant that I did a lot of what the postgrads did, but I would not be examined and I wouldn't get a degree out of it. At the time, I was also responsible for two young children, Adrian and Katrina, because I was living with their mum, Patricia. Now, she had a full-time community health worker job. This meant that I had to organise my times at college around childcare duties and school hours. As a consequence, I gravitated towards the letterpress room at Goldsmiths, not only to indulge my growing passion for typography, but also because it was very easy to break off midway through a typesetting project, park the type matter in one of those three-sided metal storage trays, which we called galleys, jump on the bicycle, and pedal off furiously in the direction of Charlton and the school gate. The following year, as it happens, Goldsmiths invited me back, but this time they paid me as a part-time tutor and technician in the letterpress area. My duties involved looking after 17 postgrads and trying to keep upwards of 500,000 little metal types properly organised in the type cases, which, given that students don't like to tidy up after themselves, was quite a challenge. But to be perfectly honest, these forays into letterpress technology didn't have anything to do with my other practical freelance work of designing and artworking magazines and newsletters, annual reports for voluntary organisations, books and booklets, leaflets and the like. Most of the type I used in those projects was produced on various types of machine. So now for a bit of background about typesetting machines. The first typesetting machines were invented at the end of the 19th century. Great big clanking things with molten lead in their veins, which cast metal type on demand. The monotype machine dominated in the book trade until the 50s or 60s. The linotype machine, which as its name suggests, cast a whole line of type as a single slug of type metal. Well, it hung on in the newspaper trade until the mid-1980s. This was known as hot metal typesetting. Professional publishers didn't do their own typesetting, they commissioned it from printing companies. But smaller publishing units in business, or government offices, or academia, or involuntary organisations where they couldn't afford professional typesetting, they turned to what, by contrast with hot metal, got called cold composition. Now, basically, to be honest, this was posh typewriter technology. My first experience of this was in the mid-1970s, working for Luz Verminda Francisco at the Europe Third World Research Centre. I typeset the body text for our publications using an IBM Executive Model D typewriter with a one-time-use carbon film ribbon. The Executive Model D was a proportionally spacing typewriter. That means a lowercase letter L, or an I, or a full stop or a comma, they took up much less space widthwise than, let's say, a capital M. Compared to an ordinary electric typewriter, the result looked more like the real proportional type that you'd find in a magazine or newspaper. The letters just fitted together better, and the result was more attractive, and I'd say more legible. The limitation of the Model D, of course, was there was only one typeface, and it was only in one size. When I moved to Oxford and started to work for the development campaign Third World First, I got some new publishing toys to play with. Our main way of preparing text for our magazines was with an even more famous IBM electric typewriter, the Selectric. IBM Selectric typewriters carried the entire typable alphabet on a spherical element, often called a golf ball. In less than a second, you could change from one golf ball element to another one, completely changing the style of type, even in midline. I think at Third World First we had a collection of 6 or 7 fonts on these golf ball elements, and I think they also came in 2 sizes, 10 characters to the inch and 12 characters to the inch, and there was a lever to select between the two on the machine. However, the Selectric typewriter did have limitations. Compared to the Executive Model D, it was in one respect a backward step because the fonts were all monospaced, all the letters the same width, not proportional like in proper typesetting. However, there was a fancier and much more expensive version of the same essential Selectric golf ball concept, which a lot of small printing companies used for more professional-looking typesetting. This was the IBM Selectric Composer, and one of these cost about as much as a car. Now, at first glance, the Composer looked like a wide Selectric typewriter with a few extra buttons and knobs down the side. It also used golf ball type elements, but these fonts were proportionally spaced, and they came in a range of text sizes and styles, from about 8-point to 12-point, I think, based on well-established font designs such as Bembo, Garamond, Times, Baskerville, or Helvetica. Some of these composers had an internal electronic memory, or they could store a typesetting job on a magnetic card. Having typed a column of type the first time round, making your decisions about where lines should break, for example, you could flip a switch and have the machine printed out all over again, but this time with the word spaces adjusted to make a so-called justified column of type with flush straight column edges both on the left and the right. I did get to play with one of these composers later. Also, after I married Seng Usa Sutitanakun, we acquired an Olympia Supertype, very impressive machine. I think that was in 1984. The Supertype was a bilingual Thai and English electronic typewriter with a selection of interchangeable daisy wheel type elements for each language. And these fonts were proportionally spaced, too. Clever stuff. But to rewind, when I worked at Third World First, my means of setting type were strictly limited to the ordinary Selectric golf ball typewriter, and Letraset for the headlines, of course. Little did I suspect at that time that computer technology was already on the march and taking over the professional end of typesetting. Indeed, I confess I knew next to nothing about computers then, but that changed when I met Nicola Bourdillon. Nicola was one of the great loves of my life, I must say. We were together in 1978 and the first half of 1979. She wasn't much older than me, but she seemed to have lived a lot more. She'd been to China in the years of Mao Zedong. She travelled in India and on the Trans-Siberian Railway, and in Africa. She was a well-read feminist and was sexually adventurous, and she had a keen intellect. When I first met Nicola, I worked for Third World First and she worked for Oxfam. By the time we were lovers, she'd taken a job with a peculiar Oxford institution of the time called Daily Information. Daily Information was a one-sheet news poster distributed all over Oxford each day, certainly all of the colleges, and it was supported by display and classified advertising. The company also rented out electric typewriters to students and undertook thesis word processing, even mathematical and journal typesetting. Nicola learned to be a maths typesetter, which was done using some kind of computer system. I wish I could ask Nicola just what kind of computer system they used for this back then, but it's too late because, unfortunately, she died in the 1990s of an unstoppable tumour of the brain. In 1979, I went off for a five-month trip to Thailand and Malaysia. By the time I came back, she'd taken up with somebody else. I lost contact with her for several years after that, but I must say she'd changed my life, and she'd made me aware of a link between computers, the organisation of text, and typesetting. In the 1980s, Nicola joined Research Machines, the Oxford-based manufacturer of computers for British schools. The other day I searched the internet to see if I could find any evidence of Nicola's existence, and the only thing with her name on it was the programmer's guide to the Z380 microcomputer, which she had edited. So this memory of mine is Nicola's partial obituary. But now I must move my story onwards, towards my own encounter in the 1980s with computerized photo typesetting. Another technical aside is called for. In the 1960s, several companies were at work devising how to imprint the shapes of letters onto photographic paper and film. In these photo typesetting systems, the font was carried as a series of tiny negative images on a film strip or a disc, which was made to spin rapidly. When the desired letter came round, a flash gun fired and the image of the letter travelled through a set of focusing lenses to be printed onto the paper, which was later developed in a chemical processor. This quite complicated photographic printing head was moved mechanically across the roll of photographic paper, exposing one letter at a time until the end of the column was reached, and then it zipped back again. Really, it was like a photographic version of a daisy wheel printer. Not a bad way to think of it. Now, I came across phototypesetting machines towards the end of 1980, when I was living in South London with Patricia. My former employers, Third World First, asked me to design a newsletter. At about the same time, the campaign against Depo Provera wanted me to design and produce a book for them. Now, I don't remember where the recommendation came from, but I was very fortunate at this time to be introduced to a very proficient phototypesetting compositor by the name of Shanta Towani in Bounds Green, North London. Shanta did typesetting for a number of publishing houses using AM Verityper machinery. The Verityper fonts, I remember, were carried on glass discs about 5 inches across. I don't think you could have more than two or three installed in the machine at any one time, so as a designer you had to take account of that. The Verityper machine was, well, kind of L-shaped. The larger part was the actual photosetter, and sticking out at 90 degrees at one end was the operator's workstation. Basically, it was like an old-fashioned word processor with a text display on a green screen and absolutely no preview of what the job would look like when printed out. Shanta took the typescript that I supplied and she input the text into the Verityper. At the same time, she was inserting the control codes, which did things like select the font, change the type size, set the letter space and line space. And also she took decisions about where lines should break, because in those days there was no automatic line-breaking algorithm, no hyphenation dictionary, for example. As the job was being typeset the first time round, it was also being stored on an 8-inch floppy disk. After the so-called galley output had been proofread and any mistakes marked for correction, not that Shanta made all that many mistakes, the floppy disk could be reinserted into the machine. The job would be called back onto the screen to be corrected electronically before being printed out again. Shanta was such a fast and productive operator, she had not one Verityper in her living room, but two. because, you see, when one of the machines was directed to print out a formatted text, it could take quite some time. So she just swapped over to the other machine and started a new job. Her efficiency and earning capacity was such that Shanta's husband, who'd been a GP, gave up his practice to act as her office manager. However, despite the pace at which she worked, Shanta was enormously generous to me with the time that she took to explain the best way to mark up instructions on TypeScript copy and also how to mark proofs for correction. Another very useful source of instruction for me at the time was the book Photo Typesetting, a Design Manual, written by James Craig for Watson Guptill Publishers, which became my typographer's Bible and Vade Mecum. Now, Shanta lived and worked way north in Bounds Green, but after I started at Goldsmiths College, I discovered another typesetting shop down the road in Loam Pit Vale in Lewisham. It was called Jubal Multiwrite, and it was run by Father Francis, I forget his second name, an eccentric Anglican priest. I used Jubal for a few jobs, and then in 1983, I took space in a room on their first floor and set up my own little graphic design studio. Jubal had a Selectric Composer, which I played with, but their main machine was a Quadratec Photosetter, a bit more advanced than the Verityper. It also used fonts that were physical negatives. In fact, each font was sandwiched into a Perspex quadrant, hence the Quadratec name, so you could have four fonts loaded at once. For example, you might have Baskerville, Baskerville Italic, and Baskerville Bold for the body type, and Franklin Gothic Bold for the headlines. By adjusting the lenses within the light path, the machine could make type from tiny 4-point up to... I think up to 72-point. I can't remember if it used 8-inch floppies or the new 5.25-inch floppies which were just coming out. I do remember that it was multi-user, and Jubal's machine had two input terminals sharing the central CPU unit and output device. I remember one time I actually organised a visit to Jubal by the postgrad design students from Goldsmiths. You see, I felt I had a duty to rescue them from the delusion that modern typesetting was done with lead type, which I think they might have believed from what they were being exposed to at Goldsmiths. Now, a word about the maths of typesetting. Back then, you certainly didn't just rush into commissioning a phototypesetting job, not if you had any sense, that is. You did your copy-fitting calculations first. Do remember, these systems weren't WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, because that green screen just showed the characters that had been entered and the formatting codes. Now, just suppose you'd requested the type to be set at 12-point size with a 14-point line feed, and when you got the printout back, you found it was too big to fit the page space you had available. You might retrospectively have to change the typesetting spec, maybe to 11-point type, or else you could edit the text down, cut the words out, have it typeset again. Either way, you'd be quite legitimately charged for operator and machine time and materials cost. You'd been wasting the typesetter's time. The smart thing to do was to mathematically model the process in advance, before going anywhere near the typesetters. Now, the first step, as John Craig's book taught me, was to estimate the total of all the letters and spaces in each paragraph of the typescript. Not one by one. There was a smart way to do that by marking a vertical line for the average line length, which might be, let's say, 70 monospaced characters, then multiply by the number of lines in each paragraph. You then had to know how many characters would be generated, on average, for each line of the typeset material. Quadratec, indeed all of the typesetter manufacturers, gave their customers, the typesetters that is, a fat three-ring binder of type samples which also contained copy-fitting data. Thus, for example, I might read in that book that when it was set at 10-point, a particular font would, on average, generate 2.23 characters per pica, that is, per sixth of an inch. So a column of type set at 18 picas wide would contain, on average, just over 40 characters, spaces, and punctuation marks. In short, the copy-fitting job involved a lot of repetitive maths, but the prize for doing an accurate copy-fit was that you got the job typeset faster and cheaper. And if you were also good at proof correction, the job would be ready for paste-up with only the second printout. And boy, was I good at it. I once figured that my copy-fitting estimates were out by less than 2%. Oh, and this, by the way, is where the microcomputer entered my life in a small way. I'd started reading Personal Computer World just for my own general education, and it became obvious to me that the copy-fitting process just involved plugging some variables into an equation, then applying the same equation to a batch of data derived from measurements of the text paragraphs, over and over. So why not automate it? I bought a little Casio PB100 pocket computer, primitive thing, with 1 kilobyte of RAM and a 12-character LCD text display. But I taught myself some programming in BASIC, and it was good enough for automating my copy-fitting calculations. There was something else I noticed about computers. Father Francis, who ran Jubal, wanted a third terminal for inputting typesetting jobs, but to buy one from Quadratec would have been very expensive. Instead, he bought a cheap Sharp microcomputer and software which made it behave like a Quadratec front end. It could even write a floppy disk so that the Quadratec would be fooled into thinking it was one of its own. So I began to see that a typesetting job could start electronically on one system and then be moved to another one for output. And all of this experience stood me in good stead when Seng Usa and I were invited, in the autumn of 1984, to join the Workers' Cooperative publishing the magazine Inside Asia, edited by Larry Jagan and Tony Kahane. I took responsibility for all aspects of typographic design, TypeScript markup, and copy-fitting, and the two editors and I did the proofreading as a relay team. Typesetting was provided by a company in Kilburn, run by former Malaysian student Dunstan Chan. They ran a CompuGraphic Modular Composition System kit. The MCS was a representative of the next generation of typesetting machine, because it was a CRT setter. That meant there was no longer a physical font as a photographic negative. Instead, images of type characters were generated by software on the screen of a cathode ray tube. This in turn meant that all of the fonts for which the typesetting company had purchased the license and software were available and online at all times. You could do some little changes to the shapes of the letters. I think we had our headlines set as Franklin Gothic, but reduced to about 94% of the normal widths. And freed from many of the mechanical constraints, output was also damn fast from these CRT setters. And from 1 year after we started Inside Asia, we even had one computer in the offices at Pentonville Road. That was Larry Jagan's Amstrad PCW word processor. At just under £400, the PCW was a bargain, and it introduced millions of people, particularly writers, to the benefits of word processing. However, there was no way that the text files that Larry could generate on his PCW could be transferred electronically at that time to Dunstan's typesetting system. So all of Larry's Amstrad texts got printed out, marked up by me, and sent on paper by motorbike to Kilburn to be keyed in all over again, with all of the possibilities for error that that brings in. Ridiculous? I guess so. But that's how things generally were back then. Phototypesetting, generating long rolls of bromide paper, followed by scalpels and adhesive to make camera-ready artwork. But then, one day in autumn 1985, Seng Usa and I went to a reprographics exhibition, where we met a little beige Apple computer which was about to change our lives. But that, well, that's another story.